I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're looking at the revolutionary political thinker and leader Rosa Luxemburg, whose work encompassed a great many different areas. And to make sense of it and to provide some understanding of it all, I'm speaking with Peter Hudis, who is the general editor of the Complete Works of Rosa Luxemburg. 14 volumes are anticipated. The first will be coming out next year. And he's also the co-editor of the Letters of Rosa Luxemburg and the Rosa Luxemburg Reader. World War I proved to be a moment of great consequence for the socialist movements of the time. What was the fate of the Second International, that alliance of socialist parties around the world, when World War I broke out?
The Socialist International was very good. Second International was very good at passing resolutions at its congresses every year. That said, that because it was no secret ever since the turn of the century that a conflagration was going to be breaking out in the European continent, and certainly since 1910 with the Morocco incident, Germany and France virtually went to war over who was going to take over Morocco. It was very obvious that war was on the horizon. But the Second International was very good at its party conferences year after year, passing resolutions that said, in the advent of a declaration of war by any of our national governments, we will simply oppose the war and we will join hands with our brothers across the border to bring this war to an end. That's what they proclaimed. Sometimes these proclamations were written by Luxemburg herself. Other times they were written by others, but the point is, it was taken for granted, at least in rhetoric, that that's what the perspective of the Second International was. There were signs already earlier that something was amiss, however. So, as I mentioned, 1910, Germany and Morocco almost went to war over the dispute over who was going to take control of that, what became a colony. And Luxembourg's colleague, who had sided with her in the debate against Bernstein, Karl Kautsky, pulled back from a kind of militant position on this issue. Insofar as early as 1910, he had said that the German party should not make too much of an issue over the possibility of war looming with France over the Morocco crisis, because he was worried about the German party losing votes in upcoming parliamentary elections. He wanted to tone down some of the rhetoric. It didn't even look to most people at the time that this represented a significant concession to militarism, but Luxemburg already smelled that something was rotten and broke off relations with him in a very contentious debate, and a very important one, in which he wrote a number of really quite remarkable pieces, some of which will finally get to publish for the first time in English in the Complete Works. But by when 1914 happened, and the great pressure was applied, of course, what happened within days is that the German Social Democratic Party voted for war credits on August 4th, 1914, and did the exact opposite of what it said it was going to do for 30 years previously. And so did virtually all the other socialist parties in Europe.
And then she was imprisoned, was she not, for opposing World War I?
Right. She was imprisoned in 1915, 9 months after the war broke out, for a speech that she gave before the war even broke out. She had given a speech in which she said that if a war breaks out, what socialists will do is advise soldiers to turn their guns on their own commanding officers, which did not sit very well with the Prussian militarists. So they charged her with sedition. She had a very good lawyer who at least kept her out of jail for the first months of World War I. She then had her trial, and she really gave one of the most remarkable speeches in the history of European radicalism in the defense of her trial. She says, yes, I advocate sedition. I advocate opposition to oppression. This is the principles that I live by. It's a really beautiful speech that she gave. Then she was incarcerated from 1915 until the end of World War I, until the second week of November 1918.
She was remarkable, although I guess not entirely unique, in her opposition to imperialism, which in fact predated World War I. And her major economic work, The Accumulation of Capital, is based around an understanding of the economic basis of imperialism. Can you tell us about that work? What did she argue in The Accumulation of Capital?
As I mentioned, Luxemburg was a real brilliant economist in her own right. And she really began to do this work on an analysis of imperialism quite early in the late 1890s already, just about the time she arrived in Germany. She recognized that there was a new stage of capitalism, of imperialism, that had emerged. But unlike people like Hobson, who are liberal theorists who kind of argued that imperialism was the product of political machinations of Western powers, she wanted to show that imperialism was an inevitable product of the economic law of motion of capital. That is, capitalism is inexorably driven to imperial expansion and then destruction of non-capitalist strata. So she did a lot of research on the non-Western world. She wanted to understand both why capitalism and how capitalism exactly takes over and destroys non-capitalist social strata in the developing, what we now call the developing world. And she also wanted to understand what's the internal dynamic within capitalism itself that strives, that compels capitalism to strive for incessant global expansion. She already actually started developing this in a book that she began to write after 1907, between 1907 and 1909, The Introduction to Political Economy. Unfortunately, it has never been published in English in full, but it will be published this year. That's going to be in the first volume of the Complete Works of Rosa Luxemburg, along with about 10 other manuscripts that have only been recently discovered in the past decade or two of associated writings of her on imperialism, the self-expansion of capital, and the impact of capitalism on non-capitalist social strata in what we now call the developing world or the third world. This all culminated, of course, in her greatest magnum opus. Her major work was The Accumulation of Capital in 1913, where she explored this in great detail. And essentially what her argument was that capitalism is driven to imperial expansion because capitalism is incapable of realizing a surplus value within a given national boundary. In other words, capitalism is generated not only by producing tremendous amounts of value, workers are the source of this value, in pumping out huge amounts of unpaid hours of labor, but the surplus value, the discrepancy between what the worker is paid and the value that the worker produces, cannot be bought back, cannot be reconsumed by either the workers or even the capitalists. That is, a point gets reached where so much surplus, so much value, so much capital is produced by the workers in productive enterprises that neither workers nor capitalists purchasing their luxury goods can buy back the sum total of the social product. Therefore, she argued, capitalism is compelled to take over non-capitalist social strata, commodify them, turn them into something that is connected to the capital relation in order to buy back that surplus product that cannot be consumed internally on a national scale.
So in other words, the core needs to create new markets in what we might call the developing world, non-capitalist economies, at least a century ago, so that they can buy the goods of the core capitalist countries.
Yes, and or at least realize the value of the goods produced by those core capitalist countries, because you can't simply produce a good. It has to also be consumed, and also the value in it otherwise is not realized. And she argued that this realization of value cannot occur within a closed capitalist society comprised simply of workers and capitalists. So therefore, imperialism to her was simply the manifestation of what we now call globalization. That is, globalization was a necessary concomitant of capitalism. She recognized this long before many others did, and that capitalism would be driven inexorably to take over the entire globe and to destroy non-capitalist social strata. Now, what's less known about all of this is Luxemburg was extremely attentive to indigenous social formations in the non-capitalist world itself that was being impacted by imperialism and in many cases destroyed by it. And she had a very positive evaluation of things like communal forms of social organization in non-capitalist agrarian societies. She studied very carefully India before and during the British process of colonization. She studied the Middle East. She made extensive notes on the work of Maxim Kovalevsky, a Russian sociologist who had done a very important analysis of Islam and social relations in Muslim societies in North Africa and northern India. And completely unique for her time, as far as I can tell. She made an extensive studies of conditions in sub-Saharan Africa, and she singled out what she called the tenacity and creativity of pre-capitalist communal agrarian relationships, communal relations of owning and working the land, that she held that in many respects were more advanced and more developed than capitalist social relations themselves. So on this level, again, you see Luxemburg kind of challenging this unilinear evolutionist perspective on at least one level, that the more advanced country is the more capitalistic, the more economically developed in a quantitative sense. She was very appreciative of these pre-capitalist forms, and she wrote a devastating analysis of the way that these forms are destroyed and annihilated, or at least attempt to be annihilated, in the course of European imperialist expansion.
Peter Hudis is the general editor of the complete works of Rosa Luxemburg, which will be out over the next number of years, 14 volumes in full. He joins me from Chicago, and the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. So Rosa Luxemburg's life was cut short in horrible circumstances in the revolutionary ferment that followed World War I. She was finally released from prison, and 2 months later was murdered. What were the circumstances of her political assassination, and what was happening in Germany immediately following World War I?
Yeah, she was released from prison on November 1918, this was following the German Revolution, which overthrew the Kaiser and installed a quasi-democratic, I emphasize quasi-democratic regime, led by her former colleagues in the Social Democratic Party, who now took state power. But, of course, there had been a split within the party at the beginning of World War I, actually a three-way split. Luxemburg and her allies, who were principled opponents of the war, there was a kind of a centrist faction led by Kautsky, the independents, and there were the Social Democrats that had now won power in November 1918. The leader of the Social Democrats at that time, Friedrich Ebert, made the famous comment that he dreads social revolution like the plague and would do everything in his power to prevent it from occurring. He was really representing the really conservative, skilled trade union leadership that viewed socialism as purely a distributive question of providing benefits and wages for workers, but not risking any kind of social transformation that would change the foundations of a capitalist social organization.
And so he was from her erstwhile party, in fact.
Yes, from her former erstwhile party. They were colleagues before, well, at least they were in the same party together before 1914. Luxemburg worked incessantly in this period to try to move towards a second revolution, that is, a revolution that would inaugurate a genuine socialist transformation, because she recognized that the old guard of German society was now aligned with the Social Democrats. They were putting on kind of a liberal face to a regime that was still largely run by the military and the industrialists. And she worked incessantly from the 2 months that she lived, from the mid-November 1918 to the end of her life, when she was freed from jail, mid-November 1918 to the end of her life, to push for a second revolution that would move things in a more radical direction. Her own organization at the time, however, the Spartacus Bund, or the Spartacus League, was very small. They were a very minoritarian organization. There was a very complex political situation that opened up. It was a very exciting period because you had a spontaneous emergence of workers and soldiers and sailors councils that sprung up throughout Germany. You had a kind of independent locus of virtual dual power that emerged in December 1918. The events moved very quickly. Things became very radicalized. But her own party was still relatively weak and was certainly not in the position to be able to guide events according to its own will. Luxemburg insisted, I should add, that, and she had her eyes on the experience of Russia in 1917, as this was part of her criticism of the Bolsheviks. She argued that her party, or any party that she is a member of, will never seek to impose socialism from behind the backs of the masses. They will never seize power and try to impose socialism without the conscious stated will of the majority of working class people in Germany. This was one of her most fervently held principles. So she supported social revolution, but she supported a majoritarian social revolution that was consciously supported and engineered and involved the mass of working class and oppressed people in Germany itself. The Freikorps came, they arrested her and Karl Liebknecht, her colleague and ally, and they were murdered that evening.
Well, let's spend the few minutes we have left talking about her legacy. One of the key aspects of her legacy was her insistence on democratic socialism or democratic communism. She famously wrote that freedom is always and exclusively freedom for the one who thinks differently. And her critique of the Bolshevik Revolution was not made public during her lifetime, was published after her death. What was the nature of that critique, and in what sense does she represent kind of a different legacy within Marxism around how a post-revolutionary society might be organized?
Yeah, I think this is her most important contribution, her conception of what happens after the revolution. And this has been the greatest weakness of radical movements, I think, since Marx, has been a failure to adequately address what happens after the revolution, because she certainly was aware that mere state control of society through nationalization of property would not necessarily ensure liberation, even though many people wrongly assume that it would. She supported the Bolshevik seizure of power in 1917. She said they were the only ones that dared in Europe to take this kind of action, but she recognized the very serious obstacles they were facing externally, but she became very critical very early on of the internal dangers to the revolution posed by the Bolsheviks' disregard for democratic governance. In other words, she was horrified at the formation by the Bolsheviks of the Cheka, the secret police, the shutting down of free expression, newspapers, magazines, free expression, a monopolization of power in the hands of one party. She thought all of this was inimical to socialistic principles. And in the summer of 1918, she began to draft a series of articles followed by a planned booklet on the Russian Revolution to provide a critical evaluation of what was going on in Russia and an alternative conception of what needed to be done in a post-revolutionary situation, such as the one Russia was facing and that one that she hoped Germany would soon be facing. And the cornerstone of this criticism is democracy, certainly. She recognized that there can be no socialism without democracy, just as there can be no genuine democracy without socialism. But she didn't mean by this simply political democracy, although she certainly was a fervent supporter of political democracy. She also recognized that there had to be economic democracy. You had to have the working classes not only involved as spectators or as soldiers in the revolutionary struggle, but as active thinkers and leaders as well, and that spontaneity is not just a tool. Spontaneous struggle or spontaneous strikes or what have you is not simply a tool to make the revolution, but spontaneity, room for spontaneous struggles, room for spontaneous question and development has to continue after the revolution, because she recognized that the ingrained habits of a class society, especially the separation of workers and intellectuals, the division between mental and manual labor, the way so many people who are intellectuals or political figures take for granted that they can lead and others must follow, that this gets reproduced within the radical movement itself. And that unless you had a revolutionary process that allowed for free expression, full debate, exchange of views, and indeed multi-party, multi-organizational forms, revolution would very quickly ossify into a new type of authoritarianism. And she made her views very poignantly known in this pamphlet, The Russian Revolution. Now, as you mentioned, she didn't live to publish it because she was killed. The events between mid-November 1918, when she gets out of jail in January, are so intense. Your entire time was taken up trying to prepare for social transformation in Germany. Her life was cut short in January 1919. Now, it was long argued by some of the apologists for Lenin and by many Leninists that she had taken back her criticism of the Russian Revolution contained in this pamphlet, since she hadn't published it herself, and that some had even claimed that she had made statements such as that once out of prison, she became more aware of what the Bolsheviks were actually facing and had dropped or revised her major criticisms. We now know that that is actually not the case. We have documentary evidence, letters that have surfaced, where she makes it very clear, she writes in late December, early January 1919, that she intends to publish her pamphlet on the Russian Revolution as soon as possible, as soon as events allow. And it's very clear that except for one or two relatively subsidiary points, all of her major criticisms of the Bolsheviks had not only been upheld by her to the very end of her life, but actually she had become even more emphatic in voicing them. Unfortunately, because of her death, the book couldn't have been published at the time. It was published after her death in 1922 by Paul Levy, who was her lawyer and also lover for a short period, and a longtime colleague of hers, who was one of the first leaders of the German Communist Party, which was formed from the Spartacus Bund. There's a wonderful book of collection of Paul Levy's writings that has just been published by Historical Materialism book series in England, edited by David Fernbeck, called In the Path of Rosa Luxemburg, Collected Writings of Paul Levy, where you can actually see this history laid out very clearly, Luxemburg's Prussian critique of the Russian Revolution and her understanding that the failure of the Bolsheviks to acknowledge democracy as the substantive organic principle of social transformation would strangle the revolution itself.
Well, lastly, I want to ask you if there are aspects of her legacy that you think are particularly applicable to this moment right now when renewed opposition to capitalism in some form is taking shape around the world, and yet people are still experimenting with different forms of organizing, different tactics. Do you think that people should be turning to Rosa Luxemburg, and if so, in what capacity?
Yes, I think we have to turn to Luxemburg. We need to do so critically, of course. We have to recognize that she was a product of her time. She had a magnificent theory of revolutionary spontaneity, and I think most of all we can learn a great deal from this. The Arab Spring, I think, really brings her legacy to the forefront, because this is what Luxemburg always tried to instill in people, was the notion of look for the unexpected, do not adopt that all-too-knowing look that says, oh, I know how that's going to turn out. It's not going to work out for this or that reason. Be open to new possibilities, of especially when masses of people become involved in efforts at social transformation. But at the same time, we have to realize that she was a product of the Second International. She had very important organizational conceptions and organizational theories, but I think some of them... we do need to go beyond. In other words, she wasn't as critical of some of the traditional forms of political organization of her time as I think we need to be today, where we need to be even more critical of authoritarian forms of organization, or critical of concepts like the Vanguard Party to Lead, which has repeatedly shown itself to be a kind of noose around the neck of social struggles. With that said, however, I think the two really important things that Luxemburg gives us is, one, a real sense of how to keep your pulse on the finger of human relations. She was a tremendous humanist. She wasn't afraid to call herself an idealist, even though this was a person who has mastered the field of economics and was able to capture the objective organic movement of capitalistic globalization. She was somebody who really was able to keep her attention focused on the possibilities that lie within people when they break free from adherence to the regimen of a capitalist society. And so we have a lot to learn from her in terms of openness, engagement, and anticipating alternative forms of social existence. And secondly, the real thing that we have to learn from her is this notion that we need to address the question of what happens after a revolution before it occurs. I think the greatest factor that explains the strength of capitalism is not its economic and political might, or even its ideological might in terms of consumerism or these other factors. The biggest thing that's keeping capitalism going right now is the lack of an adequate conception of what can replace it. And when you put together Luxemburg's writings on democracy, on spontaneity, especially most of all her critique of the Russian Revolution from 1918, you see in it, and it's very much brought out in her personal correspondence in the volume of letters we published last year, The Letters of Rosa Luxemburg, this is somebody who really had a conception of at least the important elements that are needed for a successful social transformation. and her insistence on not taking power, not putting the emphasis on seizing power, without the conscious, explicit act of support of the majority of people that you're seeking to liberate. This is a very difficult thing to actualize and to bring into realization, but it's a principle that we cannot change society without adhering to. And she kind of like gives us a wonderful direction on maintaining our sights at this difficult period on that perspective.
Much to think about. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking to the general editor of the Complete Works of Rosa Luxemburg, 14 volumes in total when they come out. The first is due out next year. He is also the co-editor of the Letters of Rosa Luxemburg and the Rosa Luxemburg Reader, and you can find links to those two books on our website, againstthegrain.org.